You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring international expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Chaney Kouroniotis, and today I'm talking to FSI Director and, of course, World Class host Mike McFaul. If you listen to this show, you probably know that Mike's name has been in the news recently. Today, we're taking the opportunity to step back and explore the strange turns that U.S.-Russian relations have taken in the summer of 2018, and there is no better guide than someone with your experience, Mike.
Thanks for having me. It's a reversal of roles here, right? Usually I'm the one asking questions.
That's right. But it seems like we've got more answers and opinions perhaps needed from you today than questions.
Okay.
So thanks in particular for taking the time to record this today. I didn't think you could possibly be in more demand than you were during the Helsinki summit.
Yes.
And then Vladimir Putin said, I accept that challenge. And
right.
Just kicked it up a notch. So. Yep. We're recording this at the end of July 2018. Can you briefly describe your unexpected involvement in the aftermath of the summit and where matters stand today?
Yeah. So I was actually at the Helsinki summit. I work for NBC News, and I was on stage ready to go with Lester Holt to give coverage, immediate reaction to the press conference. And in that press conference, President Putin laid out a proposal whereby he would allow American interrogators to witness actually the interviewing of the Russian 12 Russian GRU officers that had been indicted by Mr. Mueller just a few days before, in return for his interrogators to witness the interviews of a dozen American officials. And at the time, he said American intelligence officers who they believe were part of a criminal conspiracy to launder money out of Russia and to help Hillary Clinton, by the way. So the money allegedly was laundered out by a businessman named Bill Browder, and then a portion of that money went to the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016. So he laid this all out in Helsinki, completely crazy scheme, nothing. You know, he invented this entire thing. And, you know, just to back up a little bit, this is classic whataboutism by Vladimir Putin. He does it all the time. Moral equivalency between something Russia might do and what we might do. So a classic example, for instance, is Russia annexed Crimea, and then he'll say, well, what about Kosovo? To assign moral equivalence between what Russia does and the West does. What was different about this is that he assigned moral equivalency between an indicted intelligence officers that Mr. Mueller indicted. Those are facts. That's a real indictment. Whether they're guilty or not, you know, we need to decide. But the other part he invented completely, to the best of my knowledge, that there's no evidence whatsoever that any of that happened. So that's a new escalatory step. And I said that at the time, and I said, honestly, I said at the time, I think the president, President Trump, unfortunately called this an incredible offer or a nice proposal. I can't remember the exact words. And I said at the time, my guess is that President Trump just doesn't understand what's going on here. It's kind of complicated, the MLAT treaty. What I didn't know at the time, and I learned the day after, was that I was one of the people that Putin was actually referring to. And I learned that when the prosecutor general's spokesperson went on the record in Russia, in Moscow the next day, and outlined this conspiracy and then named 11 or 12 of us as being confederates in this Browder money laundering scheme.
So you first heard about this, you've said, from Russian journalists getting in touch with you on Twitter.
Yes.
About it while you're on the flight home from Helsinki.
That's right.
What went through your mind?
Well, it may have been Twitter, Facebook. I don't remember the platform,
sure.
But it came from Russian journalists.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I was flying home, Finnair from San Francisco to Helsinki to San Francisco. So it was a long flight.
Mm-hmm.
I first thought it had to be a mistake. It had to be a garble. That happens a lot in dealing with the press, right? But the more they would then send me articles and the more I saw, the more I realized that it's not, and that they were seeking to question me in order to prove my guilt in this crazy scheme that Putin had talked about. Now there's some real weird in the weeds things that may be too in the weeds, but a curious thing in the list, I was the last one named in the list. It felt like they kind of just added me at the end. Kak izvestna, for those of you who speak Russian, as is well-known, McFaul. And then that went on to explain that it wasn't actually my activity as the U.S. ambassador that they were concerned about. It was my work at the White House coordinating policy with respect to our reaction to the wrongful death of Sergei Magnitsky, a lawyer that Bill Browder had hired to defend his economic interests in Russia. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the crime I committed, you know, in quotation marks, allegedly, was my job working on policy at the White House for Barack Obama.
And you think Putin is trying to create something of an equivalency there between the job you were doing for the United States government and presumably the job that the 12 indicted GRU officials are doing for their own government?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Very explicitly saying, if you're going to charge our Russian government officials, we're going to charge your American government officials.
Right. So how likely is it that you might actually be forced to submit to questioning from the Russian government? Is that Putin's aim? And if not, what is?
So at the time, I didn't know. Today, I think I can report that I think that's all extremely unlikely. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that there was a public reaction to this idea for the first instance. Then at the White House, the press spokesperson said, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, we are exploring the idea. And when she said that generated even more outrage, public outrage, mm-hmm. to the point that there was a hashtag Protect McFaul circulating and punctuated by a 98-0 vote in the U.S. Senate saying, and a resolution saying, under no circumstances should Americans be interrogated by the Russian government.
Those votes are hard to come by these days.
They are very hard to come by. I spent a lot of time, I probably met more members of Congress and senators in the last week than I have in the previous decade, because everybody wanted to talk to me about it. And that was a good news thing, by the way. We came together, Democrats, Republicans. People made some dramatic speeches, including some Republicans. And they actually handed me a commemorative copy of the resolution when I met with about a dozen senators last week and saying, we have your back. So that's the good news. Mm-hmm. And it'd been nice had the president said that, but we got to that. And I met with many Trump administration officials at the White House, at Treasury, not at Treasury, at Justice and State Department. And I came away from that thinking, that's not going to happen. What I don't know, and this is the drama for the future, is will the Russians seek to detain me and the other people on the list when we travel to third countries? And the way they can do that is through an organization called Interpol, mm-hmm. Where Interpol can issue, at the extreme, it's called a red notice. And I think that's unlikely, by the way. It's hard to get a red notice. It has to be adjudicated through the Interpol system and their headquarters. But there's a lesser thing that I don't think a lot of people understand called a diffusion. And Russia can issue a diffusion without going through headquarters and put it into the system. And then they can request, not demand. I think, and I'm not a lawyer, so, you know, for all you listeners, if you know the facts, you know, hit us up on Twitter and give us the right facts. I'm just learning this all. You know, I'm a policy person, not a legal person. But to the best of my knowledge, they can do that not as a requirement from the host country, but as a request. And this happens quite frequently. And the Russians are known for abusing the system, including most famously with this UK business person, Bill Browder.
So there's the potential, even if low probability, that you could travel to a third country in the course of doing your scholarly work for Stanford. And if that country's administration is friendly with or wants to curry favor with the Russian government, they could choose to detain you. Could they transfer you to Russia?
Well, so that's exactly right. And I think the political question that you just raised is exactly the right one. And for my job, I don't just go to friendly NATO countries. I go to places. I have a trip scheduled for Belarus, for instance, in October, that I'm going to have to think about whether I want to go to Belarus. Again, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but in theory, yes, they can detain you. And then if they have an extradition treaty, they could send you to Russia. Now, I want to underscore, I think it's a low probability event that they'll try to detain me. I think it would, think of the political, public relations disaster, both for Russia, but also for the host country, to detain me for what everybody agrees is just a completely made up crime. But it's not zero, and it's not a number one. So if I'm detained, then I think it's an even lower probability that they would actually send me to Russia without allowing the U.S. government to get involved. But it's not zero.
Right. And so even should none of that actually come to pass, they've already had something of an impact on your life and your work by forcing you to take this into consideration.
Yes.
When you travel.
Yeah.
Right. And sort of have that chilling effect.
Yeah. Well, I would say there are two or three dimensions. It's a good question in that. One, yeah, I have lawyers. I am thinking about where I'm traveling. I have a strategy to reduce trauma that has to do with all kinds of entities for when I travel now. That is new. I never thought about that before. Number two, the other thing very practically that this means is, I don't imagine myself ever traveling to Russia for a long, long time. Now, I was on the sanctions list before this event as part of the tit for tat. So I was already on the visa ban list. First ambassador since George Kennan to be on that list, by the way. So good company. But in the back of my mind, I'd always thought about, we'll get this resolved. Eventually, I'll get off the list and then I'll go back to going to Russia. There's no way I would risk that at this stage, mm-hmm. given what the prosecutor general's office said. And as a very practical matter, that already has impact on my life. So I write about Russia. I got lots of books that I've written about Russian politics, Russian economics. To write as a scholar about Russia requires that you go there to do research. Qualitative research I've done, quantitative research I've done in Russia before, where we surveyed Russian individuals. I can never do that again. So that part of my academic career is effectively over. I write about other things. It's not like my academic career is over, but writing, I don't imagine myself ever writing a book about Russia ever again. And then number two, just on the personal level, I have hundreds of friends and acquaintances, maybe thousands in Russia. And the only way I'll see those people is if they come to see me. I can't go to see them. And that's happened to me now for 4 years, and that's sad. I mean, there's some people I've literally not seen for 4 years that I used to see over the course of 30 years, like every 2 or 3 months.
So thinking about the reverberations of this, not only personally, but politically
yes.
and more broadly, is this, for those who aren't familiar with the back and forth between U.S. and Russia and the former Soviet Union, is this normal sort of Cold War type stuff, or is this a significant disruption of historic diplomatic norms? Where does this fall on the scale of international relations between two countries
yeah.
that have been adversarial and are now nominally not?
Yeah, I think it's a new level.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm not an expert on the Cold War, but I'm probably more expert than most. I don't ever recall a time when a U.S. government official was accused of a crime the way that I and the other 11 individuals were, right? And remember, when you're ambassador, you're supposed to have immunity. You do have immunity. I don't know how it works as a White House official, but that is extremely bizarre to me that I could be accused of a crime in Russia for doing my job at the White House. Think how crazy that is. But the second thing that's bigger than me and even bigger than Russia is the following. I wish our public posture on this as a government would be a little more emphatic and pronounced, because the signal it sends to autocrats all over the world is that they can bully American government officials. This is an intimidation tactic. Let's be clear. Putin doesn't like me. I wrote a whole book about it. It's called From Cold War to Hot Peace, documenting our long, difficult relationship. He doesn't
recently
like me.
Hit the New York Times bestseller list.
Yes, I guess, silver lining of all this drama. But seriously, it is a way, and I'm just one of many people that he does to intimidate you, to threaten you. And think about if that became the norm, autocrats all over the world would start using red notices to chase their opponents. And what I've learned just in the last week, that in fact that happens with other autocratic regimes using this Interpol system to chase critics of their regime around the world. And maybe because of this unfortunate experience for me, it might lead to some real re-examination about the abuse of the Interpol system for political purposes. That's around the world,
right.
But for Americans, let's be clear. We're talking about tens of thousands of diplomats, soldiers, development workers, Peace Corps volunteers working all over the world. We cannot make them susceptible to arrest because of what autocrats don't like their political views.
Right. So if it may feel as though America is withdrawing its protection from its citizens around the world.
That would send a dangerous signal, I believe.
Right. Now, if these norms really have been damaged so deeply, do you think they can ever be reestablished or are they gone for good?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I think the first is Interpol. They need to reestablish their credibility. By the way, paradoxically, the last article I wrote in Foreign Affairs about a month ago about U.S.-Russia relations, for those of you who want to find it, it's called Russia As It Is. I said in there that Russia should be suspended from Interpol for using Interpol for political purposes. Little did I know when I wrote that I'd be writing about myself.
Almost makes you wonder if that's related.
Well, who's to say? But I do think a more closer inspection of how this is used is that would be the first norms to get right, the multilateral norms. With respect to Russia, as I say in that piece, I'm actually not optimistic we're going to get back to a better place while Putin is in power. I think time and time again, he has demonstrated that he doesn't respect international norms. So this is the same guy that annexed territory for the first time since World War II in Europe, and when he annexed Crimea 2014. Horrible, dangerous precedent for the international system if that can happen. This is a guy that intervened militarily to support Assad in Syria, a man who used chemical weapons against civilians in his own society. Another international norm violated. Putin went along with it. This is the same guy that violated our sovereignty in 2016, intervened in our elections to help Trump and hurt the other candidate, Secretary Clinton. A gross international norm that was violated, and he doesn't seem to care. So I'm not optimistic that he's going to change his behavior anytime soon. And that's why, as I wrote in that piece in Foreign Affairs, I think our best option right now is to try to contain that belligerent behavior abroad.
All right. And so to wrap up, let's do a little bit of looking ahead, right? So you've said that right now there appear to be two U.S. policies towards Russia, that of the Trump administration and that of the president himself in his own communications via Twitter and otherwise. How do you see this, given that variable, how do you see this situation playing out in the coming year or 2 years? What scenarios come to mind?
I honestly don't know. Mm. It's such a confusing time because what you just said is also unprecedented, just like we talked about Putin being unprecedented. I can never remember a time when the president had one policy and the rest of his administration had another. I guess if I had to predict, it's probably going to be more of the status quo because there's so much consensus about the need to push back on Putin. That said, we see a president that is more confident in his foreign policy instincts, although Helsinki might have been a real setback for him. I mean, so that's a real wild card that I don't know how to predict. Before Helsinki, I would have said he's getting more and more confident in his instincts, and he's just saying, I don't care about my advisors. And he's done many things time and time again to demonstrate that beyond Russia policy. Helsinki was a complete disaster. And I think many in his own government believe that. And so maybe that will have a sobering effect. But just to be clear, he's also said he invited Putin right after that to come to Washington. And then Putin said, why not come to Moscow? And he said, sure. So to try to predict what Trump will do with respect to foreign policy is pretty hard to do.
Right. Well, I think we can at least predict that there will be a considerable amount of need for your expertise going forward in the months.
And everybody here at FSI, because he also says these things about North Korea. He just said he wanted to meet with the Iranian leaders. So thankfully, we have a deep bench here that can talk about all these things.
All right. Well, we will wrap it up for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike. You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We'll be going on hiatus for a few weeks, but we'll be back in your feed in September with some fascinating new research from our scholars. If you like this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.